As I said, my name is Mark Peters. I work for an analyst company called ESG, not the one that's going to be talking to you today. You will have this fine gentleman in the second, if you're handy. So, August 9th, hopefully you're all in the right room. I could say this is session U1, but I wouldn't know what that means. So this is one about, as it says there, the annual update on flash technology. Let me do my couple of little bits of duty here. Number one is to introduce your speaker. So, this is glasses on time. You may have had a chance to read some of this, but I want to read the formal stuff and then make a couple of additional comments. So, Jim Handy, to my left, your right, is President of Objective Analysis, Strategic Marketing and Market Research Firm for the semiconductor industry. He's got over 30 years of experience, including 14 as an industry analyst, which means I can match you on the 30, but not quite on the 14 as an analyst. I've done it for 9 now. I have no idea how someone does for 14 years, but I don't know, I'm looking around the audience here. There's a few other people. Who else has got 30 years in this business, one way or another? There's a few of us. Which is amazing when you think that's half of the time we've had modern IT. But anyway, so it's no wonder that things change rapidly. Anyhow. Jim was at DataQuest and Semico Research, presents a lot. I'm sure some of you may have seen him before. This is always a great session. Writes a great deal, interviewed a great deal, quoted a great deal in the press and elsewhere. He writes Chip Talk blog for Forbes Online. He contributes to two of the blogs on objective analysis, the SSD guide and the memory guide, which is good when you think of the called Flash Memory Summit, since it incorporates both those things. He's the author of the cache memory book and a patent holder in cache memory design. So, pick a fight with him afterwards. BSWE from Georgia Tech and MBA from the University of Phoenix. Those are all the facts, which I think are interesting. You obviously want to hear from someone who knows what they're talking about. I think there's something more important than Jim. We've done a few of these sessions. I'm so glad last year when we did this, do you remember baking hot? The aircon wasn't on in the room properly, so we should be better today. But the best thing about Jim is not only does he understand this stuff, but he wants you to too. And he has a very, I think, comprehensive way of describing what's going on in the industry. He obviously, it infuriates him, but he loves it too. And hopefully, if nothing else, you will leave here with some perspective. We have about an hour. You may see me wave my hand at Jim furiously with sort of 5 or 10 minutes to go, just so he knows. And what about questions, Jim? If someone has a question?
Why don't we leave them until the end?
So I'll make sure we have a few minutes at the end for that. Okay? Please join me in welcoming Jim Handy.
Thanks a lot, Mark. Very flattering introduction. So, first a word from our sponsor. There and there. I put those in so that this is like our forecast accuracy over time. But I put those in so that the online version will have an advertisement for us whenever we do it. I'm going to talk about the NAND market, give a little bit of an update on 3D NAND because there's a lot going on nowadays. Talk about SSDs and a little bit about what IOPS needs are. I'll briefly mention the NOR market because there might be a NOR person in here. And then I'll talk about 3D cross-point memory, which we had a session on last year. So let's first talk about the NAND market. Revenues continue to grow, although a little bit more slowly in 2015 than they have in past years. The very easy dynamic between growth in the NAND or DRAM markets and the way that you tell revenue growth is basically the bits are going to grow at a certain rate, and they tend to grow at a relatively steady rate. This just depends on demand, and so where we've had softness in pricing recently has been because demand has fallen off, which is a really hard thing to forecast. But bits are growing, somewhere in the 50% range. You end up, if your pricing is stable, then you end up with 50% revenue growth to go along with that. Pricing tends to go stable during the shortage. We've had an oversupply, a mild oversupply for the past year and a half, and so because of that, we've had growth that's been below that, and we had growth that was about, it was like 15% last year. So there have been price fluctuations, but there's nothing like what you'll see going from 2007 to 2008, which is a total collapse, which is typical of what you get during a big oversupply. We're anticipating for that collapse to happen somewhere in 2018 because it's a very regular part of a commodity cycle. And I'll get into that more in the future. Actually, the next slide. So we're expecting to see roughly stable prices through the middle of 2018. And that's going to be driven by the fact that 3D NAND is really hard to make. It's nothing at all like what anybody has been making for planar NAND in the past. And that's driving some big problems. And I'll get into why that's happening in a lot of detail pretty soon. But once 3D NAND becomes cost competitive with planar, which it is not today, then we expect to see a big oversupply of chips, because that means a lot of capacity is going to go from being used at something, you know, like 50% efficiency up to the 90s. By the way, the slides will be online probably this afternoon. They're pretty quick putting them onto the website for the Flash Memory Summit. But while we have stable prices, then there should be profitable NAND flash for most people. They'll either be getting their profits from planar, which they can make cost competitively, or in some cases they'll be making some profits off of 3D NAND. And so there will be an awful lot of profits in there. Now, there's expected to be big investment from China. China, you know, Tsinghua Unigroup, I think it is planning on making some very large investments in NAND flash capacity. Those investments haven't even started yet, and it's going to take a couple of years for those investments to actually turn into full volume production capacity. So we're not expecting to see China be a major factor in this until the downturn hits. But in 2018, which is a real guess, because we're trying to figure out when is everybody going to learn all of the secrets that are needed for 3D NAND to yield effectively. But whenever this does happen, then there will be a price collapse because capacity will end up going from an undercapacity to all of a sudden being well used, and there will be an overcapacity as a result of that. So I call this a capital expenditure-driven overcapacity. And it will be augmented by the investments in China. The results of the investments in China will not be the collapse, although I'm sure that China will receive an awful lot of the blame for the collapse. They'll actually just be a sorry participant in the thing. What will be the effect of the added capacity from China will be that the downturn will last a little bit longer than it would have in a normal situation, because the downturn lasts until the demand catches up with the capacity. Capacity ramps in stair steps, and demand tends to ramp relatively evenly. And so when the demand ramp is over the flat part of the stair step, then you've got an undersupply. When capacity comes on steeply and crosses over demand, then you end up with an oversupply. And so that's what we're thinking is going to happen in 2018. I'll show you a graphic of this shortly, but we're expecting to see the largest gap between price and cost before the end of this upcycle. So this is DRAM. I like to use DRAM as a proxy for what's going to happen in NAND flash, because the two of them behave very similarly. This is price per gigabyte, and it's on a logarithmic scale on the vertical axis, because otherwise it would end up looking like some kind of just a curve that you couldn't really read anything out of. Typically, the costs for DRAM come down about 32% per year, and this shows their bumps in there. The bumps, where it goes flat, that's flat pricing during a shortage, and where it comes down very sharply, that's the market correcting by completely eliminating the gap between price and cost. We had two periods of shortages that were driven by technical problems in the mid-90s and in the mid-2000s. The first one, the 1993 to 1995, flat pricing actually came from a difficulty, and you have to kind of like ratchet your mind back to these low densities. This was going from the 4 megabit to the 16 megabit DRAM chip. Now we're at 8 gigabytes. But when the industry was going to that, the PC was becoming a big factor in the market, and it couldn't use 4-bit wide and 1-bit wide versions of a 16 megabit part. That would have forced the OEMs to put in a larger memory than what the PC buyers would have wanted. And so they needed to have wider memory chips. They wanted 16-bit wide chips. And these 16-bit wide chips, everybody thought, oh, you just add 12 more bits to the 4-bit wide chip. But it ended up causing internal noise problems to the chips. It caused their yields to plummet. And as a result, the manufacturing capacity was not being used effectively because they were using the stuff that was aimed at making 16-megabit chips to use to make 4-megabit chips inefficiently. That finally got changed after about a year and a half of struggling. The DRAM manufacturers learned how to get rid of this noise problem. So that sounds like a really trivial problem, but it caused a year and a half delay. I wasn't following the DRAM market. I was with Semico in 2005-2006, and so I'm not as intimate with what went on in 2005, but something about 90 nanometers just really, it was extraordinarily difficult for the DRAM manufacturers, and they ended up not being able to move from 130 nanometers to 90 nanometers as quickly as they had thought. That meant their capacity wasn't being used effectively, and once again we had a shortage, and so we had a collapse. And the reason why I'm showing you this is because these are two individual technology things that are causing a 1 year and a 1.5 year difficulty. With NAND flash, 3D NAND, you're going to have an awful lot more changes going on. And I'll get into some detail with those in a little bit. So it's hard for us to tell when 3D NAND will be mastered. You know, Samsung and Micron are shipping it today, but it doesn't imply that the cost for 3D NAND is lower than it is for planar. I do believe that planar is still a more cost-effective technology, but that's not a detail that the NAND flash makers are willing to share with me. Other vendors are sampling, and most have been sampling for about a year, and they're saying that the big ramp will be next year. They used to say that the big ramp would be in 2015, so we're already 2 years late in that. And these are optimistic projections. And so we're just saying, and I want to really reinforce this as a guess, we could be wrong on the long-term side, we could be wrong on the short-term side, but we're just guessing that it's going to be mid-2018 when that collapse happens. So what's so hard about it? You know, I talked about there being one thing that caused these stalls in DRAM. And in 3D NAND, which this is a cross-section from Applied Materials, 3D NAND has got an awful lot more things that they're trying to conquer at one-time processes that have never before been done in the world of semiconductors. And so the one that most people point to is high aspect ratio trenches. These are trenches that have to be 40 times as deep or 60 times as deep as they are wide. And they have to be etched perfectly on either side, and they have to be etched through multiple materials. And there are all of these different things that all of them are unique processes that have never been done before in the world of semiconductors. I'm not going to leave this up here for you to read. If you want to get copies of it, you know, by downloading the online thing, that's fine. But I am going to put a blog post up about it pretty soon on the memory guide. And on the memory guide, I'm also going to put up the next slide, because this is trying to bring to the real world, which Mark said I like to do, is, you know, what are these problems like in the real world? So here's my analogy, is some of you may have gone on business trips where you had to drive a car. Can I have a show of hands? Who's had to rent a car on a business trip? Come on, more, yeah, okay. So let's say you get in the car and there's this trip. What makes things hard for you? You know, something that you do every day is usually a very simple thing. Well, probably the first thing is getting used to the car. In April, I was in Austin, Texas, and the car dash had this thing that I don't know what it does, but I had to take a picture of it and share it on Facebook with my friends. And, you know, I don't know if it does origami, or if it does animal cruelty. but whatever that button does, I didn't touch it. I did adjust the mirrors and, you know, learned where the different controls were and that kind of stuff. So that's the first hard thing. And I didn't tell you, I'm sorry, I meant to lead into this, is you have arrived in the airport, you're supposed to be across town to your meeting in 30 minutes, which is about how long it should take to go across town. So, you know, that's the first thing. Second thing, oh, sorry about that, I backed up. Okay, so the second thing is, I know this isn't going to resonate with anybody from outside the U.S., but in the U.S., Nobody drives with a stick shift anymore. Very few people know how to drive with a stick shift. And so let's say the car comes with a stick shift and you have to kind of learn how to do this. Okay, so that's another problem that you have to confront at the same time. The next one is, what if you come from a country that drives on the other side of the street? And so I put a picture of Winston Churchill here, because before he was Prime Minister of England during World War II, he was on a trip to the United States, and he looked the wrong way before stepping into the street and got hit by a car and was hospitalized for 3 months. So being on the wrong side of the street, it can be a really challenging thing. So you've got these three challenges. Let's make it worse. So this is a picture of a GPS that I use, also in Austin, Texas. Some of my weirdest driving has been in Austin, Texas. And you can't really see it too easily in the picture, but this thing is telling me that I need to make a zigzag across a freeway. In Austin, they've got these very peculiar ways that you drive, where if you get in the far left lane, in the left turn lanes, you're forced to make a U-turn because they put a wall around the lane. And they don't really tell you that. There are different standards in different areas, and that makes it hard to drive. I was in Vancouver, B.C., and this was back in the 70s. They've probably changed by now. They used to have a convention where the light would be red, and then it would start to flash. And when it started to flash, that meant you could make a left turn. And I was sitting there at the stoplight. It started flashing. I'm wondering what it was. The guy behind me is honking. You know, so you don't know what the conventions are in the place that you're driving. That makes it hard. But what's even harder is that your GPS speaks a language you don't recognize. And that's okay, because you can use road signs. But, you know, the road signs are in a language you also don't recognize. This one's from Greece. I was in Greece once trying to find Alexander Street, and it was the hardest thing in the world because I didn't know what letters Alexander went into Alexander Street. Close to Roman letters, but not. And then finally, today is the day that you're wearing your new glasses for the first time. You've never worn glasses before. So all of this, imagine doing all of this at the same time and trying to make it across town in a half an hour. That's what making 3D NAND is like. And so that's why there's so much trouble. So ignoring the cat folder. I said that it would drive a shortage. I showed you those DRAM shortages that were flat like that. And this is kind of a visualization of what happens during a shortage, is that you get flat pricing, but costs continue to come down. They're not going to come down on a straight line like this. They're going to vary depending on how much difficulty people have. But whatever happens, if you have flat pricing for a year, you have a big collapse. If you have flat pricing for 2 years, you have a much larger collapse. And the shortage that we're kind of facing here, you know, that I really expected to start earlier, except for the problems driving demand, but that shortage should drive a collapse that may be the biggest in the history of the semiconductor business. So I just want everybody to be braced for that.
Can you put a number on that?
Your typical big collapse in the semiconductor market is a 60% price fall in about 6 months. A bigger collapse would be a 70-80% price fall in the same amount of time. And what happens is that the prices come down to cost, and in rare instances they go below cost. When they do go below cost, then the U.S. and European governments put trade sanctions on the offending suppliers. And so generally people come down to cost and then they follow cost until the market balances out and demand equals supply. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about SSDs and IOPS. And we think that server penetration could be a lot better for SSDs. We, you know, from our estimates, it's still only about 50%, and so that means that there's a very big upside potential. There could be a lot more SSDs sold into the enterprise. Hard drive makers are feeling the impact because the enterprise hard drive market is kind of falling apart in their hands. It's a little bit surprising, it's a lot surprising to me, that Seagate has not taken this enterprise SSD hard drive market that they had complete dominance of and turned that into dominance of enterprise SSDs, but they don't seem to have moved quickly enough to do that. But, you know, something that's a really hard problem for these guys is that a lot of times people were getting the IOPS that they needed by putting a lot of hard drives in parallel with each other. And very early on in the game, SSD makers found out that you could take out, you know, 35 hard drives and put it in one SSD and get the same performance. And so you've got what I call one-to-many replacement, where one SSD is replacing a number of enterprise hard drives, and that's really taking its toll on the enterprise hard drive market. But also the overall hard drive market is soft, and that's because of a couple of things. PC OEMs and cell phone OEMs were expecting for most of their new market in 2015 and 2016 to develop in emerging economies. And so this would be China, this would be oil-producing countries. China recently had currency devaluations, a couple of them, middle of last year, late last year, that reduced the buying power of Chinese consumers. And so as a result, these people have not been able to buy the PCs or cell phones that they had hoped that they could buy. You've also got the OPEC nations, and you know the price of oil has been falling like crazy. It's down around $40 now. I remember back in 2007, I think it was $140. And so you've got that problem. That's causing those developing economies not to be able to buy their PCs and cell phones either. And the PC market is what drives a lot of unit volume of the hard disk drive. And so PC consumption has turned into bad hard drive consumption. But we're still seeing strong shipments, anticipating strong shipments for PCI and SAS SSDs. You know, this is mostly PCIe. This is enterprise PCIe, and I'm not counting in M.2 in this. And so this is from a forecast that we have going to be doing an update of in the fall of this. For client SSDs, you know, PC SSDs are not meeting the expectations. I think that ever since, 2004, 2005, I've been hearing that the PC market is going to suddenly slam over to being all SSDs instead of all hard drives. But unfortunately, PCs are not bought by people who understand the sophistication of SSDs and why they should pay more for a gigabyte of storage. And so because of that, Apple accounts for the majority of new PCs shipped with SSDs simply because of the fact that they tell their customers what they're going to buy and the customers end up buying it. They also charge a little bit more, which they can do. But what's interesting is that the big market for SSDs and PCs is the upgrade market. And that has a funny kind of an effect because when people upgrade their PC with an SSD, then they put off buying a new PC. And so because of that, then you have lower PC sales. And so that also impacts the market for hard drives and for SSDs. But other markets are doing well because in markets where people are putting SSDs into servers or into other applications, they really understand what the benefit is. And mostly in financial type applications where people count the transactions that they're able to perform per second or how long it takes for them to reconcile numbers, they can turn that into a dollar figure that then they can compare against what the price was of the SSD and find out that it's a good thing. And so we still see, you know, very positive growth in SSD shipments and expecting to see, you know, hundreds of millions of units shipping in the very near future. You know, the current softness, I think I went into some detail on this right now. The PC market's not doing well because of exchange rates, but also the price of oil. And because of the developing nations were the targets for growth. And I also mentioned that older PCs are not being retired as quickly, and so PC churn is not happening as quickly as it usually does because of SSDs extending their lives. And this is something that Kingston was the first company that I know of to take advantage of this, and SanDisk did it relatively recently too, is that they will have a team of people go and talk to a number of IT managers. They invite them all to a dinner or something like that, and they say, bring a PC, and then they swap out the hard drive with an SSD for the PC, and they say, use this for a week and see whether or not you want to upgrade your entire company's fleet, your corporate fleet of PCs. And they usually come back and they do that, and then they can put off their PC purchases for the company for another year or two. Enterprise demand is strong, and so you know there's a lot of demand in the cloud with hyperscale companies doing well in that. and enterprise hard drives, as I said before, are losing sales in SSDs. Something that's been a thing that's gotten in the way of flash actually being able to perform as well as it can is that we've got hard drive interfaces that everybody is using to put the flash behind. And the old thinking was, because of the fact that flash is storage, make it look like a hard drive. And I say an IDE because the first ones that came out were like that. Gradually, people started noticing that this flash wasn't performing as well as it could, and so first they put it on SATA, and then they made SATA faster by going to SATA 3, and then they put it on the PCI bus, and there are some efforts to bring it to the memory bus. I think Diablo was the first company to do that with their flash on the memory bus. They did come out with a second version of that now. Netlist has something that they're working on that's going to put that on there. And so there is going to be a faster way to attach NAND to the memory bus. And it's just kind of, you know, the market's very slowly adopting to that because of the fact that we've got this very strong mindset that storage has to go behind a hard drive interface. And it's not just the hardware interface, but it's also the software interface that gets in the way. To better understand this, Tom Coughlin and I ran a survey, and we actually started running it in 2012. We then continued running the survey and have updated the results of it and came out with a report just this week that has this on it. This is the IOP survey, and we asked a number of people, what is the problem that you're trying to solve with fast storage? And so, you know, they gave what their applications were. Databases and OLTP are the biggest in there, but, you know, we had a number of other applications there. And, you know, we asked them to give what their IOPS needs were. What's interesting is if you take a weighted average of what the IOPS needs were for the four biggest applications, you'll see that science and engineering is the biggest column there. And we got an average of about 3 million IOPS that people wanted for those applications. We think that the database and OLTP people are a whole lot more pragmatic about what they need. And so they gave much lower numbers, but you know, as far as where they are, they're the ones that are about the biggest users for that. I had a question here.
Standard 4 gigabyte IOP size?
Yeah.
Opposed to something larger?
Yeah, this is just 4 gigabyte random IOPS. Anyway, so we put together stats out, you know, just all kinds of statistics on that, and they're all in this report. So buy the report, maybe you're rich. But what we find too, you know, outside of the report, is that there are different needs for different levels of applications. So for client applications, we saw it go from 2.5 inch, which is still a very strong interface, but it went into mSATA for certain very small form factor applications. And this is migrating today over to M.2, which we're expecting to see PCI M.2 end up becoming the prevalent standard in there. In the data center, in the very first SSDs that were used in enterprise applications were fiber channel. That quickly moved to PCIe, but then it's interesting, it kind of backed up and went to SATA interfaces. And the reason why was because people tried PCIe and found out that was really good, but then they started trying the faster SATA interfaces and found out that wasn't that much worse. So first they took a very, you know, big and expensive approach to this, and then they backed up and said, can we do something cheaper, and they did. And the data center also is a place where people were looking for very high endurance levels and then backed off as to what kind of endurance levels that they needed too. And then in the enterprise, we had, I think this is interesting, but the enterprise went through these changes where first they were using direct attached storage. That means actually having a hard drive or an SSD inside the server. That's where you get it fastest because you don't have to contend with the network slowing down your accesses. And they did that, but then when virtualization took over as a software approach, then direct attached storage was getting in the way, and so they went to shared storage in SAN, and a lot of focus was put on extending the SANs. When SSDs came back in, and the SSD makers, you know, mainly Fusion.io at the beginning, was telling everybody, no, you really need to put this back inside the server. And that met with an awful lot of objection because of the fact that it was going back to DAS. But what we've got now is we've got software-defined storage, which is what that SDS is on there, that now you've got sophisticated programs that do a lot of management of the DAS, and they make up for the fact that even in a virtualized environment, you need to be able to get this information that might be in another server's storage. And somehow or another, they manage that. But I think I said before, the PCIe is an interface that's in a very good position to take over. We're moving into an area where the client PCs and other application client applications are going to have PCI sockets, extra PCI sockets that you will be able to plug your storage into. And NVMe on top of PCIe really does a lot to get the most performance out of NAND flash. And so we're expecting for PCI to become the volume leader, especially since the thing that was really standing in the way of massive PCI adoption before was not just the availability of PCI sockets, but it was also the high cost of PCI controllers. But controller costs are going down for PCI. They're very shortly going to be on a level with PCI costs. And so because of that, you've got an interesting dynamic that you've got the enterprise wanting to use SATA because it's cheap, but then the client wants to use PCI, and so they're going to make PCI cheap. So probably what's going to happen is the enterprise is going to be moving, first it moved from PCI to SATA, and then eventually it's probably going to move back over from SATA to PCI. There's a question over here.
Yeah. Why aren't PCIe controllers more expensive than SATA controllers?
Well, historically, the reason why, in case anybody didn't hear, why are PCI controllers more expensive than SATA controllers? And historically, PCI controllers have been implemented using either FPGAs, which are a very expensive technology, or custom ASICs that are not built for a volume market, and so they're not cost optimized. But that is changing, and the major SSD controller manufacturers all have PCI SSD controllers that they're making, and they're not making them for this narrow market that was the Fusion I/O or that kind of market. They're making it because they have faith that they're going to be able to sell a number of these to the client. U.2 I find to be a puzzling kind of a standard. That's a PCIe in a 2.5-inch case. And the driver, as far as I can tell for this, is that there are a lot of data center managers who think that storage is unreliable. And, that comes... a lot of the problems that disk drives have a reputation for having are problems that have been solved for probably over 20 years. But we still have that reputation, they just can't shake it. And so because of that, then the SSD makers are kind of bundled in with the hard drive makers, and SSDs are also viewed as being less reliable than, say, a DRAM module or something like that. No server has the DRAM modules available for hot swap on the front panel. But there are all of these servers and storage arrays that in the enterprise that have the hard drives available for hot swap. And so U.2 was created for people who wanted to be able to change their SSDs the same way. You can't hot swap PCI cards any more than you can hot swap DRAM. And so U.2 was a solution to that. But we're expecting to see a short life cycle for U.2 because of the fact that there are existing sockets for that. But we don't see a lot of new sockets being developed for front panel changeable PCI, but most of the PCI is going internal to the box. So I've had people tell me that the enterprise is never going to move to TLC, and this is a slide that I actually pushed from last year's show, but I like it, so I'm showing it to you again if you've seen it. My apologies for that. But back in the good old days of SSDs, once people understood that SSDs wore out, then it ended up that in the client that people were using SSDs that were made of SLC, but they never figured that MLC would ever get in there, nor TLC. You zoom ahead a few years, and stock, just that was the shortest word I could figure to put in there, so I wanted to put common. But you go down to 2009, and MLC SSDs really started being introduced into the client. And then finally, you got the phase out of SLC SSDs, and most of them were MLC, and TLC really started coming into the market in 2012. Well, when the enterprise market started out, then no flash was good enough for the enterprise. And then eventually we got to the point in 2008 where it was unusual to have SSDs in the enterprise because they were still viewed as being unreliable, but everybody said, we will never have MLC SSDs in the enterprise. Well, it was only about a year after the first MLC SSDs appeared in the client that they started appearing in the enterprise. And so even though today it looks like TLC is not likely in the enterprise, and I'm talking about planar flash, not 3D NAND, then, you know, I would expect to see TLC eventually make its way in there, certainly with 3D. Something about 3D is that the TLC in 3D is a whole lot, it behaves a whole lot better and it wears a whole lot better than TLC in planar NAND. So that moves us over to the norm market. Like I said, you know, there are not very many companies that are in this market any longer, and the reason why is because it's a diminishing market. NOR used to have its major market in cell phones, back before the smartphone. And the reason for that was that if you wanted to put NAND on a smartphone, you had to execute out of DRAM. That required you using a demand paging operating system, and the licensing cost for a demand paging operating system was, at that time, about $3.50, which was more than the value of the NOR they were putting in the cell phone. And so nobody would pay an extra $3.50 to be able to convert to a cheaper NAND flash technology. And as smartphones came into being, all of the smartphone operating systems used demand paging. And so because of that, if you were going to be paying that the licensing fee that you needed for the operating system, and if the operating, you know, if you were going to be paying that anyway because you needed a smartphone, and if it had demand paging in it, then you may as well use the demand paging to reduce your flash costs in your cell phone. And so that basically ruined the flash market for cell phones, and this market has been hurting ever since. The companies who are in it, we've got Spansion, it was the leader. They've been taken over by Cypress Semiconductor. Numonyx, a few years ago, was taken over by Micron. They were number two. And then Micronix is in that market as well, Microchip to a much lesser extent through their SST. And then you've got some smaller players there. But when you've got a market that's under $2 billion in sales, then you can't divide it up all that many ways. So as I said, cell phones were a key market. Since smartphones have taken over, then you can use NAND and DRAM in that. And that created an oversupply, which caused prices to come down to cost. And which is the dynamic I was talking about when I was talking about 3D NAND flash. Same thing here. So vendors either exited, which Samsung did. They went from being number one to being a complete non-participant in the market. Because of the fact that there's not demand growth and the prices are eroding, you have revenue erosion. So finally, let's talk about 3D XPoint. So I like to say it's last year's news because of the fact that it was introduced actually on July 28th of last year. But it's still not out. But I'm expecting this week to hear an awful lot about it, and we've got a session at the end of Thursday where we're going to be giving a recap of what we've heard, you know, various members of this group, what we've heard on it and what our opinions are. I still believe that it's a very good fit for the memory storage hierarchy. That because of the fact that it's faster than NAND flash and slower than DRAM, and it's cheaper than DRAM but more expensive than NAND flash, that it should fit in there. And it opens up the door to the idea of storage class memory, which is something that computer designers, computer architects, have been looking for a number of years. They've been expecting to do it with MRAM or some version of ReRAM like XPoint. And so because of that, there are applications being developed for it. One of the big ones is the in-memory database. But there will probably be other applications where people need to have the resilience of storage, but they'd like to have the access time of memory. It will... Okay, another question?
I made a how crowded can that hierarchy be? So we've got SRAM, DRAM, flash, disk tape at the moment. We introduced Crosspoint. Is there room for other memories? Now, if Crosspoint takes that position, will MRAM and ReRAM be left out?
So the question is, how many levels can there be in that hierarchy? And it's however many make sense. You left out three levels when you were saying what we have now, because there are three levels of internal cache and external cache with processors. So I've got another chart that I didn't use in this presentation that shows the L1, L2, L3 cache, DRAM, 3D Crosspoint, NAND flash, hard disk drive, and tape. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if I were to talk to you in 10 years that I'd be adding another one or two to that. SSDs were not on that hierarchy even 5 years ago. But there is going to be a huge effort in supporting this. You've got DDR4, and none of the DDR standards can support variable access time. In the good old days when I was designing caches, then you used to have a little pin that you could use on the processor's bus and say, wait a minute, I'm not ready yet. You can't do that with DDR, and so they had to have a workaround. One of my cohorts on the session that we had on 3D Crosspoint last year very loudly asserted that they'd have to redesign the DDR bus. But there are arrangements that you can do with flags and software being polling software, that will get past that on a standard DDR bus. And so that's what I'm expecting to hear is used with these, what Intel calls Optane DIMMs. There will be operating system support because of the fact that Intel's behind it. Intel is going to make whatever investment it takes to do that. And they'll do it using cache and memory management techniques, which is close to home for me. But the applications need to support persistence. And there's not an awful lot of already existing off-the-shelf software that can use that. There will be once this becomes prevalent. And everybody will say, gee, how did we do without it? But right now, we're doing very well without it. But SNIA, the Storage Networking Industry Association, has put together a programming standard for how to use memory that also is non-volatile. It's the non-volatile programming standard. Linux has something called PNEM, their initiative, and there are actually people in the Linux community that are putting together hooks for that. PNEM stands for persistent memory. And instruction support for certain instructions is now available in the Intel instruction set. Intel has instructions where they can tell persistent memory that if there's anything that's in DRAM on a persistent memory module, that it needs to get pushed into the persistent memory because a power failure is coming on. They also have instructions for moving things out of the internal caches of the register set of the processor into persistent memory. So they're looking ahead for this. They've given that to the programmers. SNIA and the Linux community have given tools to the programmers too. And so now the applications programmers have to write programs that will really do whatever's the best they can do with that. The big problem, and this is a slide that I borrowed from last year too, the big problem with Crosspoint is that it's just a moment. Or, I'm sorry, why don't I go ahead? Yeah. Was it back on this slide that you wanted?
Yeah, what did they call us? Crosspoint is continuing and beginning PUI.
It all depends on where the costs go for that. NVDIMM, okay, so the question was, is 3D Crosspoint competitive with NVDIMM and NVDIMP? And NVDIMM is a standard DIMM with standard DRAM in it, with a couple of additional components. It's got NAND flash that's as big as the DRAM, that can take a copy of everything that's inside the DRAM into the NAND flash if there's a power failure. And it's got a management chip that manages the process of moving the stuff from the DRAM into it. And so because of that, it's more expensive than DRAM. And so it's not immediately clear how that fits into the memory storage hierarchy, because I think that in the slide before that, this middle thing, faster than NAND, slower than DRAM, costlier than NAND, but cheaper than DRAM. NVDIMM doesn't fit into that. And so because of that, that means you have to have an application where you're willing to pay more for your memory for that to go in there. Now, NVDIMP, as far as I understand, is a standard that can also include the 3D crosspoint memory in a DIMM. So I don't think that there's a competition. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the bulk of the NVDIMP market ends up being 3D crosspoint. Okay, great question.
Are the sizes of data being moved from 3D to 3D crosspoint the typical like 4K byte OS pages, or are they different than that?
One of the advantages of a storage class memory is that you can have much smaller things. And so they talk about byte level, but processors actually do transactions in 64 bytes.
So cache lines.
Cache lines, exactly. Okay, so back down to the chicken and egg slide is there. And I'm sorry about the buzzing. There's a little thing that I can plug into my computer for sounds, and I keep touching it. So I just, there's something that I say with 3D crosspoint is it's a chicken and egg problem, and just like the tale that I told you about 3D NAND being expensive and costly to manufacture and stuff like that, crosspoint is going to be like that until it ramps to volume. So it's going to be a very expensive technology to build, even though, according to Intel and Micron, the chips have 10 times as many bits on them as the same size DRAM. Even though they have that, they're not going to be able to translate that into a lower cost until they get up to volume, because the volumes of scale are extremely important in this. And so 3D crosspoint will sell in volume once it's priced lower than DRAM. And you would expect it to be priced above costs, the manufacturing costs. But 3D crosspoint prices won't fall below DRAM until the volume is close to the volumes of DRAM. And so because of that, what I'm seeing is during the time that it takes for 3D crosspoint to ramp its way into the market, it's going to have to be sold at a loss. And this is a problem that I think that Intel and Micron have a solution for that mostly involves Intel making up for that loss. Okay, there's a reason for that, though. Intel, I like to say that Intel can sell a processor that is $50 more if they have a platform that can take advantage of the speed of that processor, which is the whole reason why Intel wants this, is they want the platform speed not to be the thing that slows down the processor. So if they can sell that $50 more processor by losing $10 on the 3D crosspoint memory that they're selling into the system, that makes really good sense. And so I think that's the approach that they're trying. It's a gamble, but that's the way that I think they're going to be doing it. So in summary, we see NAND growth continuing. We're expecting the 3D transition to create shortages, and so we're saying a price collapse is going to happen in the middle of 2018. I think that we're not going to really know that it's happening until it's in progress, because of the fact that learning and knowing how that's going to happen involves having everybody who's making 3D crosspoint or 3D NAND tell us their biggest, most innermost secrets, and I'm not expecting for that to happen. We're expecting to see SSD growth continue with strength, although the revenues in SSDs are going to fluctuate when there are fluctuations in NAND flash pricing. And we're expecting the IOPS requirements, which I showed you some of the stuff from our report, I'm expecting for those to become much more pronounced in the future as people understand their IOPS instead. NOR flash will continue with its gradual decline. I didn't mention, but this is something that I've seen happen in several markets before where a similar kind of thing happened. Mask ROM, E squared ROM, and SRAM have all undergone this. And I'm expecting for DRAM to at some point too, just not in the really near future. And then 3D crosspoint will eventually come, and when it does, then it should change the market. So with that, are there any questions that I didn't answer? Okay, yeah.
What is the technology of crosspoint?
So the question is, what is the technology of crosspoint? And my take on that is that it really doesn't matter. As long as it does its job, and it's cheaper than DRAM and faster than NAND flash, then it could be made of peanut butter. And nobody should really care. Yeah, question.
On your supply outlook for 18, what assumptions are you making in terms of yields and layer count for the roughly 25% of wafer starts that we're running at 3D?
I'm going to do those one at a time and just repeat your first question and then ask you to repeat your second one. So, okay, so the first question was, what am I talking about when I'm talking about 3D cross-point reaching scale and whether or not that means having a new factory devoted to 3D cross-point? And I do believe that 3D cross-point is not going to be run profitably on a facility that it shares with other facilities. A number of companies have tried running NAND flash and DRAM on the same facilities. And there's a certain amount of equipment that remains idle when you switch a capacity, you know, a plant back and forth on that, and somebody's got to pay the price for that. And in the world of memories, there's not enough margin for that kind of a thing. So what Micron said was that they expected, this was a year ago, Micron said that they expected for their gigabyte production of 3D crosspoint to be within an order of magnitude of their DRAM gigabyte production. And assuming they're not going to cut their DRAM megabyte production, then what that implies is that the wafer, the chip is 10 times as dense as DRAM. That implies that they're going to be producing 1/100th as many wafers of 3D crosspoint as they are of DRAM. Now, that's probably not enough to drive the economies of scale. They're probably going to have something close to 1/20th or maybe 1/10th of DRAM's wafer volume to be able to get the costs down to where they need to be. Your second question was?
On your supply assumptions, and oversupply needs, what do you assume for yields and layer count on 3D portion of the market?
Okay, so the question was, what am I assuming for yields and layer count on 3D part of the market for the 2018 oversupply, and I'm not. This is instead being based on the idea that the manufacturers will plan bit capacity rather than planning number of layers. And that if one of them needs to use 32 layers to do it, and one of them needs to use 64 layers to do it, they'll go in those directions, and the one with 32 layers will just put in twice as much capacity. So, you know, it's much simpler kind of thing. The yields, you know, typical memory yields are like in the high 90s%, and that's kind of what I'm expecting. That's the threshold that I'm expecting to happen, is that we may have yields that are 50% or 70% or something like that, that all of a sudden go to 95%. And it's that big change that is going to cause this oversupply to happen. Another question. Okay, let's take a closer one here.
So, what do you think about yield voltage in the ME30 becoming cost competitive? And the reason I ask is that without yield voltage in the ME drives, the choice is to either mirror the data across multiple servers, which is very expensive or that, or do rate reporting of some kind, which is also very costly. So the question is, when do you think? So today, dual-ported NVMe drives are either non-existent or very expensive compared to regular NVMe drives. And storage vendors selling to data centers are hoping that the dual-ported NVMe drives will become, you know, as cheap as the regular NVMe drives. Do you know whether that is likely to happen?
So you're asking whether or not dual-ported NVMe drives will become as inexpensive as single-ported NVMe drives?
Yes, close.
Okay, no. The dual-ported NVMe drives go into high-availability applications, HA. So those are applications where the people who are buying the drives are willing to pay a lot more for higher reliability, and I would expect the market to continue to take advantage of that, not only because of the fact that they're willing to pay more, but also something that you see happen in commodity markets, and SSDs are a commodity, is that you can unplug one guy's SSD and plug in the other guy's SSD, and so because of that you choose based on price rather than pretty much anything else. Once commodity SSD makers are not going to be interested in a low unit volume market, which high availability is. They're going to avoid that market because of the fact that you need to pay more attention to those customers and you can't just focus on what your production cost is. And so because of that, I would expect to continue to see a very wide gap, just as today you see a huge gap between SAS enterprise drives and SATA business critical drives. There's, you know, very large price gap there too. Another question over here.
Yeah, Jim, given how closely tied Crosspoint is to the Intel architecture and how many alternative memory architectures are out there, do you expect competitors like ARM or IBM or even Oracle to come out in this time frame with any alternatives kind of in that between NAND and DRAM space?
So the question is, do I expect to see other processor manufacturers come out with their alternatives to 3D cross-point memory? And I haven't heard any rumblings to this effect. I expect for this to become a part of standard computer architecture in the future, but I think that it's a direction that Intel is going to follow by itself for probably a number of years for other processor manufacturers following. That said, Marvell spoke about within the past year about something they call the final level cache. And it shows that they're actually paying a lot of attention to the hierarchy of memory inside systems. And so it could be that we're entering an age where everybody is going to be focusing more attention on memory hierarchy than they have in the past. Let me go past the guy in the red shirt and all the way to the back of the room. And yeah, I could point to both of you just with a single finger here. So. And then I'll answer the guy in the red shirt, but in the back of the room, please.
Last year, you actually, I think you predicted the price collapse in 2017. So if you can recap what's changed since then, I believe it's probably lower utilization of 3D NAND or longer time it takes to ramp for 3D NAND. If you can describe the changes, why it's been now a year push. And then secondly, what would cause it, let's say, not to collapse in 18? What would be the reasons, scenarios where it doesn't collapse?
Okay, so the question was, last year I said that the collapse would happen in 2017. And I think in last year's slides I said, but we might push that out, and we have. But he's asking why have we pushed it out to 2018? And just in case I didn't stress it enough during this thing, this is a guess. This is there are times, like during capital expenditure cycles, where I can draw a line of what's happening this year, and I can tell exactly what's going to happen 2 years out. But with something like this, one of these technology things, I haven't got the faintest idea when manufacturers are going to be able to bring this thing into volume production. I know that they're 2 years late now. I know that it's still a big struggle for them. And so I'm just kind of guessing, because I need to say something, that it's going to be the middle of 2018. You asked also what would cause it to stretch out or what would cause it to come in. And there are all those problems that I listed on there, and every single one of them has to be solved before you can ship in volume. I'm expecting whenever that last problem is solved that pretty much everybody will learn it at the same time and will have a massive amount of capacity come on at the same time. That breakthrough is what's going to cause it. And I can't tell what the timing is. That breakthrough, if that happened today, and everybody started shipping 3D NAND in large volumes next month, then it would happen next month. But, you know, I'm thinking that it's probably going to happen a lot later than that. And, you know, it would be horrible, but this is something that the industry could struggle with for a long time. Something that I like to joke is that those things that I showed in DRAM that leveled off the price, they were individual problems that caused 1 year or 1.5 year delay. And if you took the 12 or so problems that are being confronted by the 3D NAND and said, okay, each one's going to cause a 1 to 1.5 year delay, that would give you up to 18 years of delay. I'm not expecting that, but I'm certainly expecting something longer. Now, I didn't answer the gentleman in the red shirt. Do you want to?
what do you mean by the price collapse? Because I've been talking to the vendors, and I already see, you know, 3D NAND prices that was at 2D NAND prices already from quotes from individual, all the major fabs are already quoting prices that are competitive to their 2D NAND. So when you say price collapse, are you expecting to go below 2D NAND, or are you expecting to go around 2D NAND?
Okay, so the question is, what do I mean by price collapse? Are prices going for 3D NAND going to go below 2D NAND? First of all, let me say that there's only one reason for 3D NAND to exist, and that is to push production costs lower than what is possible with 2D NAND, with planar NAND. So the goal for this is, you know, well below 10 cents per bit, something like 3 cents per bit or something like that. And so that will happen sometime.
3 cents per bit or per gigabyte?
I'm sorry, gigabyte. That was pretty bad. That would be pretty expensive. 3D NAND is not intended to command a premium over planar NAND. And, you know, the fact that they've been able to quote prices that are higher implies that there's some benefit. And the benefits really aren't that much. It's, they've got a little bit better wear, a little bit faster write. But overall, it's about the same thing. And so they should be price competitive with each other. What will happen during this collapse is that the prices will come down to 3D NAND costs, not to planar NAND costs. That will, and you know, if 3D NAND costs do go substantially below planar NAND costs, then planar NAND's capacity is no longer going to be, it can no longer be profitably used, and so the manufacturers will close it and sell off the assets. And we'll end up being in a relatively rapid conversion from 100% or, you know, a large percent planar to being 100% 3D. I have a question over here.
Yeah, so you're pushing out the pricing collapse roadmap. What does that mean for adoption of SSDs both in client and enterprise? Do you expect a much slower adoption curve?
Okay, so the question is, what will the price collapse and what's happening to it before flat pricing? Lack of price downs due to SSD adoption. And SSD adoption so far has not been very seriously impacted by price ups and price downs. And we've found this to be true for a number of years in the DRAM market, that there is not a lot of what economists call short-term price elasticity, that if the price of DRAM or NAND flash were to be 50% next quarter of what it was this quarter, you wouldn't see twice as much being bought. The gigabyte demand tends to grow at a very moderated pace, you know, 50% per year gigabyte increase, and that isn't changed by pricing. I wouldn't expect for SSDs to behave in any different of a way.
Got it. And then do you think there's any reason that demand curve will accelerate or decelerate over the next couple of years?
Okay, so the question is, will the SSD demand curve accelerate or decelerate over the next couple of years? A lot of people are anticipating that there's going to be some point at which PCs magically shift over to SSDs from hard drives. And I've been seeing people waiting for that to happen for a long time. I don't really believe that it's going to happen. So because of that, my own conviction is that we'll see SSDs grow at a pretty steady pace, that there won't be any time that it'll switch over. I think that if you look way the heck out, maybe 30 years, 20 years, something like that, then there's probably going to be a point where the HDD market will lose its economics, and that there will not be enough volume production for the prices to go down the way that they have historically. And whenever that happens, then the hard drive market is, you know, it's just going to collapse. But that's not going to happen for a very long time. And I think we're out
talking about a very long time. I didn't want to overrun. We're bang on time. Big round of applause, please. Hope we can have this great.